Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight, Startups, VCs, Design, and the Jobs of the Future. Our panelists tonight are Ben Nelson, Ryan Howard, Tamara Wayland, and Bruce Gibney. So I am going to, we're going to not do long bios tonight. We're going to get right into questions. I am going to start with Bruce Gibney. Bruce is a partner at Founders Fund, works with Peter Thiel. He's been involved in funding a number of very cool, very large startups. But I'm just going to start, Bruce, I'm going to start by asking you, what's the role of education in your experience for both your own experience as a funder and as a businessman and in the companies that you fund and the future of jobs?
Yeah, my suspicion is that outside of a few very arcane fields, the value of education peters out at roughly your third year in engineering school, and we can ask some serious questions about the other part of the campus. The truth is that education is fundamentally a consumption decision and a signaling mechanism, a badge. So you went to Stanford, so probably 90% of the value, for example, of getting to Stanford, which I'll pick on because it's my own alma mater, and I'll grant you that I learned nothing there, is that you know, 90% of the value accrues from simply getting in, right? And so I went to Stanford, like, that's all you need to know. So we're not overly focused, and in fact, we encourage our companies not to be particular about people finishing degrees. We are especially skeptical about MBAs. But as a general matter, you know, you do have to view education as sort of results-oriented, and if the result that you want is to be a cultured person who's able to, you know, speak eloquently at, you know, cocktail parties in Nantucket, that's fine, go to Yale. And if it's not, then I would submit to you that, you know, you should do 2 or 3 years of engineering at a good school and then consider very strongly whether or not you want to get out or whether or not you want to take a year off and expand your mind.
Great. Well, I think we'll just go down the line tonight. But so our second panelist is Ryan Howard. Ryan is CEO and founder of a very interesting startup called Practice Fusion, doing some amazing work in the EMR world. He's also an investor in a number of companies and has benefited from being funded and now has become an investor himself. One of the reasons I wanted Ryan on this panel is that Practice Fusion is doing some amazing things with their, they're growing like crazy, hiring people, but they have a real commitment to their human capital as well, and I was hoping to hear a little bit about that and what you guys are working on with that.
Sure. A little more specific to the education piece, or?
Start with the education piece, yeah.
You know, I think it's an interesting question. I have my background is a little more unorthodox than probably most of the people here. I actually didn't finish high school, got my GED, came from a low-income city, New Hampshire, and low-income family as well. And so just kind of went the path less traveled, had a son really young, worked in factories, and gained a lot of my experience from actually working. And so that was a little bit different where I had to go kind of that harder path, that path that was really difficult for me. And went to a number of schools on the way, went to UNH and St. Mary's and some other schools as well. But I just never really thrived in the academic environment myself. And so I do value it. I do tend to lean on Bruce's side. It is a badge. There's instant credibility given. We see that at Practice Fusion particularly, for some reason, the MBA formula does not work that well. So we've hired a number of them. They flame out very quickly. And I tend to think a lot of them, a lot of them, There is the debt piece, and I think Bruce will probably talk about that with the 20 under 20 and what they're trying to do. When someone comes out of school and has $250,000 in debt, can they work in a startup environment? Am I providing an environment where they're going to be able to pay back that their loans and outstanding debt? Also, it's really interesting when you always have someone come to you that goes, you know, they're fresh out of school, no real working experience, a lot of academic experience, and they say, I want to work on strategy. You know, it's really difficult to have that person actually work on the strategy or company without, you know, hands-on experience. So I think as it comes to, or as it pertains to Practice Fusion in particular, we provide a lot of that. And so we tend to, I think we're in a very fortunate physical and geographic environment where we have people that have an abundance of education here. So, you know, Berkeley, Stanford are close by, and we definitely hire from those schools. But we have plenty of people on staff, including myself, that, you know, are not from Ivy League universities. And we tend to look at – we have a really definitively defined archetype, and if the person's smart, they're simply just smart. And I think with the 20 under 20 in particular, I've met a number of these people because we are a Founders Fund company, and so I think I might meet some of Peter's archetype when he kind of had this in mind, and we talked pretty in depth about it. But these kids are super smart. They would be incredibly successful with or without school. So I think the badge is helpful. I think the network's helpful as well, but I think the experience is king, and I don't think you can learn. You know, you can't experience you can't learn how to make the hard decisions by reading infinite case studies. You have to have gone through it, learned the lessons, have the scars. So I do think there's a balance, but I think you know, the experience is king as well.
Great. Thank you. And I'd like to hear a little bit more about Practice Fusion a little bit later, because I think it's a very interesting business model. And one of the things we do want to talk about tonight are business models and what how is business disrupting or creating jobs is one of the themes that we are going to be talking about tonight. Our next panelist is Tamara Whalen. Tamara is the very recently former managing director at Cooper and has a long experience in working with a number of startup companies and a number of large established companies as well, helping them figure out just what they really need and do in the world. Tamara had worked with Practice Fusion. That was one of the ways this panel came into connection tonight. But so, Tamara, tell us from the design point of view and your experience of the larger kind of design thinking that Tim Brown and the IDEO folks and Adaptive Path and Cooper are talking about, how do you see people creating their own jobs, and how do you see people depending on mentors to do that?
Yeah, I think a trend that we're really seeing in the design community is mentoring and education out in the environment. So, you know, the last 2 or 3 years, you've really seen major corporations develop user experience groups, which was something that we didn't see 5 or 6 years ago. So it's changed the nature of how we do business. There's also a trend of universities and education groups within design firms going out and mentoring in emerging markets and basically teaching the design work that we do to the organizations out there. So there's so much innovation and technology going on that you can't necessarily learn in school, that you're kind of learning on hand, and I think the right firms are doing the right thing by that.
And what's your experience to say, for example, I know you were directly involved with creating the mobile interface for TaskRabbit.
Yeah.
So TaskRabbit is one of the things we want to talk about tonight. I think a lot of people on the different panels have different ideas about it, but
yeah.
TaskRabbit certainly is changing the face of jobs. What was your experience working with them, and what they were? You were right in very, very early in working
with
them.
Yeah, we were really early developing that whole product, and I think, you know, there was a piece on ABC News that some of you may have seen, or some of you may hire runners to do your personal errands, but I think they had a really big impact on what's going on in the economy today, that a lot of people were able to supplement their incomes that weren't able to get jobs that they typically would, given everything going on. And I think runners are making up to $60,000 a year, getting people's dry cleaning and doing all kinds of things. So I'm a single mom, have 2 kids. I use them all the time, so they make a big impact on my life for sure.
That's great. Thank you. Well, our fourth panelist is Ben Nelson. Ben was the CEO of Snapfish, and Snapfish created a lot of jobs and disrupted a lot of jobs as well. The reason I asked Ben to be here tonight is Ben is now engaged in creating a brand new online Ivy League education experience and is aiming to disrupt and make better, I think, the education. He also, and I'd like you to tell us a little bit about this too, Ben also just received the largest ever seed funding in Silicon Valley, which is pretty amazing. So tell us a little bit about that and about what Minerva is all about.
Sure. So Minerva is effectively the first attempt in the United States to form an elite university since about 1891. And by elite, we do mean kind of the Ivy Plus level. And we get to do it in 21st century rules as opposed to 19th century rules. So that what Bruce was kind of talking about as far as, oh, you know, I went to school X and, you know, I had a great time and I learned some things here and there, but fundamentally the experience wasn't worthwhile from an educational perspective. We find that for a large number of people is a given, and we think that that's terrible. Now, we can't really speak to whether or not universities do a good job or a bad job. Each university has its own philosophy. But we certainly believe that there is a way to ensure that you actually reinvent the product so that there is nobody that goes through, that doesn't go through a series of experiences that isn't just a collection of 30-some classes, but is actually a curriculum designed to shape the future leaders of the world. It actually changes the way they look at the world, changes the way they behave, changes what they know, what they experience, and we do that uniformly. And so we think that it is high time for product innovation to happen in elite higher education at the most fundamental level. And at the same time, there is enormous need for capacity because the elite schools, the Ivy, Stanford, Caltech, MIT, were about right-sized for the world circa 1984. And since then, even though these universities effectively not even kept up with population growth, they went from serving approximately the top 20% of the U.S. population from an economic perspective to actually being need-blind and serving 100% of the market, so quintupling their addressable market in the United States. And the world went from being largely in the throes of a Cold War where people were poor and generally not free to travel to the world we know today. So demand is there, and we believe that there is a need to rethink the product as well.
Okay, I think a lot of people here would like to know, and maybe Bruce can comment on this as well, and maybe our other panelists too, but so how do you get $25 million?
You ask for it.
I'd like to get it too, yeah.
How do you get $25 million? Well, look, there really has to be a combination of things. First, you have to be going after something that is worthwhile. It's going to be a hard argument to go to somebody and say, I have a derivative idea on a small market that has many competitors. Will you give me a lot of money to execute it? That's probably a bad thing. $25 million sounds, in Silicon Valley terms, like an enormous amount of money. In higher education terms, I was actually just in Boston and was told that, quite coincidentally, when Harvard brings aboard a chemistry professor, the cost to Harvard is $25 million to set up the lab, to set up everything that's involved. So in higher education terms, $25 million is effectively nothing. And so you do have to go after a market that that can support use of those funds. And you have to have, a plan that uses those funds correctly and where you can show that the use of that capital in a number of different scenarios is going to be well preserved.
Okay, well, Ryan, let me ask you, can you tell us a little bit about the disruptive model of Practice Fusion? And then also, what role, from your point of view at Practice Fusion, what role should companies play in educating and developing their talent? Because I know you're doing some very cool things at Practice Fusion.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to, so I'll keep the first part short because I pitch all day long it's a little repetitive for me. We provide, there's a federal mandate for all doctors to acquire electronic health records right now. You'll see 19 different doctors in your lifetime. Because your medical information is not available, there's 200,000 deaths a year. So we provide the entire infrastructure to let doctors do everything from manage your appointment to handle a visit, diagnosis, writing the prescription, the lab work. It handles the entire office, but also unifies all the data, so you as a patient can get to your information anytime, anywhere. Largest physician community in the country, we manage about 100,000 doctors. We have about 45 million patients under management, 2.5 million visits a month. So it's a really elaborate ecosystem that handles soup to nuts, everything you need to find a doctor, be seen, and then have your data available anytime, anywhere. So you asked about the obligation to the individual. Mm-hmm. I think, we have a... There's a couple ways we look at this, but I think at the macro... I interview every candidate still. So everyone that we're still strongly considering that is coming on board, I spend a couple minutes with them, and I ask them a couple key questions. I ask them why they want to work at Practice Fusion, what specifically excites them about the company. And we're really looking for someone that it meets our archetype, and our archetype is someone that's mission-driven. So if they're not into what we're doing, into solving, not a passion about saving lives, then if their answer is I want to be a vice president next year, they're probably a wrong fit for the company, and we won't hire on that. Are they a culture fit? So they have to fit in. Like, I mean, after a really hard day's work, I mean, if you can't go have a beer with the person, if you don't have to be best friends with them, but if you can't tolerate them over a beer, it's not sustainable for a relationship. And then kind of back to your earlier question, the smart intellectual athlete, they have to be, you know, really, really, you know, just a really sharp individual that has the capacity to do the work and scale in our environment. So that's kind of our archetype, but the questions I ask are around, you know, what do they bring to the team? Why do they want to work there? And then I talk about the culture. And when I talk about the culture, we specifically focus on, and I tell everyone this that comes to the door, we try to evolve the individual both personally and professionally while they're at Practice Fusion. And what we're seeing is over time, these two are meshing very, very closely. And there's not a, you are professional here and this is not your personal environment. I mean, Practice Fusion is where the team, you know, there's many of them here tonight, they're spending the vast majority of their day. We have many people that eat three meals a day there, that are there 16 hours a day. The team itself has spun up a golf team, soccer team, running team, ultra marathon team. There's just, it becomes a culture on its own. And our focus and our goal is to keep, you know, when we bring someone on, it's a massive investment. We want to keep them there as long as we can so they're scaling with the company. And in doing that, we have to invest in them. So it is both personal and professional, and the education component's really, really a big deal on that front. And so to answer your question, I apologize, I'm long-winded. We provide development plans for everyone where the individual identifies their personal mission, whether it's within Practice Fusion or not. We bring in outside resources for, we have professional coaches, we have management training, we have a big focus on bringing in subject matter experts. So whether it's training on SEO and SEM virality and skills we want the team to have, or whether it's wealth management and recycling and nutrition, making sure these people are happy, healthy, evolving is super critical to keeping them happy, healthy, and evolving within the environment.
That's great. So, Tamara, you are a mentor for a VC. You work in a role of mentoring new companies.
Yeah.
And you also have been involved with developing larger companies and training outside of the U.S. So what's your take on how this is all evolving and what's going to be happening? What are we going to see with the influence of VCs and this new design thinking, but also what's happening outside of America that might come back and change things back here?
Yeah, I mean, I think mentorship is really important. I think I was fortunate enough to be part of an organization called Endeavor and be in Brazil this last year and be pitched by 10 of the startups that they invested in for the year. So I think I'm a mentor for that organization. And that's simply, I mean, for me, I think in the design world, a lot of it is a sense of community and the ways in which you give back and how you're contributing to the growth of these kind of organizations. I mean, we talked earlier about the jobs that TaskRabbit is creating. There's a lot of other scenarios that technology and the design we're doing is taking away from jobs, right? So that's kind of the point of why I'm here today and what I kind of personally struggle with that a lot. So I try to play a role of just making it happen the best you can.
And what do you think is going to change in the next 10 years?
Well, that's a in what way specifically?
In
I'm like, that's a very open-ended question. I can answer that forever.
in terms of how jobs are generated and how they develop.
And, you know, I mean, I think these guys might have a lot of good insights to that as well. I think it's kind of relevant to the work that Practice Fusion is doing. I have another client who has a voice recognition technology specifically for EMRs, and that voice recognition goes directly to text, and that will actually change the dictation community, which is a huge, you know, multi-million-dollar industry, and that's going to have a big impact. So I'm really curious to watch that. You know, I can kind of have these foresights and see what's going on, and it's going to be interesting to see what actually really happens.
Okay, thank you. So Bruce, as a VC, how much of a, and this was a question we were talking about earlier, how much of a role do VCs play as a mentor to their companies, and how much is actually an adversarial role, and what are
and they're sitting next to each other.
This is a case study, actually, so this is kind of a loaded question here, and I'm hoping for a little dialogue from the panelists as well. So,
sure. Well, as they used to teach us in law school, again, not a high-value enterprise. It depends. it really does. It depends on the firm, and it depends on the general partner. I would say on average, and just to, you know, piss off my colleagues because it's one of my hobbies, on average, probably over the past 15 years, venture capitalists have destroyed probably somewhat more value than they've created in their sort of, quote, mentoring. I mean, to the extent that these people, you know, need to exercise their inner McKinsey consultant, they should just go to McKinsey and not the venture capitalist. It's like, if you care how many paper towels are being used, oh my God, the burn on toilet paper is too high, you know, go and optimize processes at GM or something like that. I think one area where I'm looking forward to the nasty grams, that and the fact that you've now single-handedly raised every seed request by two orders of magnitude, so tomorrow will be a great day in the inbox. I think the one area where there are two areas where venture capitalists can add a lot of value early on in the company's life. Later on in the company's life, if like Ryan hasn't figured this out in like 5 years, there's nothing I'm going to be able to do for him. But fortunately, you already have it figured out now. Moral support is one value. There are two things that you can do. You can provide domain-specific mentorship. There's a lot of things, you know, you either know from the area that the company is working in or that you've seen 1,000 times before and the company is just encountering for the first time. And the second thing is you can push companies and individuals to take on more risk. And I think this, you know, I wish in education that there was like a class on risk. One of the things that I think that's been leached out of the American working psyche over the past 50 years, or actually probably since 1946, is the idea that there's any risk in your life, like if you follow a reasonably tracked, you know, it's like, you know, you get B pluses in high school, you go to reasonably good college, you're going to work for 40 years and you're going to croak after you get, you know, 15 years of pension, 8 years of Social Security, or whatever it is. The simple fact is the world is changing very rapidly. It's ahistorical that there's not a lot of risk in people's lives, career-wise and in other terms. And to the extent that there is risk, simply putting your head in the ground and thinking that, you know, you're not going to have to roll the punches is a ridiculous proposition. So to the extent that you can encourage your companies and your employees to constantly, you know, push the boundaries, I think that's helpful for the simple reason that they have no choice. If we lived in 1960, I wouldn't be advocating this particular strain of thinking, but we don't, and we have to give that up. So that would be, you know, that's one area where I think we can maybe add some value.
Well, I read an article by you getting ready for today, and it was an interview, I think, with you, and you talked about what VCs used to do was fund for the future, and now VCs are funding for features. So maybe you talk a little bit about the whole movement that you have in Founders Fund about what happened to the future, and you know, we were looking for jet-powered airplane cars, and we got 140 characters. What's that all about?
Yeah, I should point out there's nothing new about what we're doing. You know, venture capital has been around for a long time. And, you know, for the first, like, 30, 40 years, it backed significant sort of highly risky innovations on the belief that, you know, one, that there'd be a significant amount of social utility created, and two, that the technological barrier to entry would allow the firms to capital to capture, and I'm going to emphasize this, you know, as a former attorney, legal monopolistic profits. So that the company that did succeed would be compensated for the risk it took. And I think, it, you know, as a venture capitalist, who I actually have one of the few careers left with no risk, you know, the funds last for 10 years, and I literally could die, and my estate could collect the management fee, so long as not enough of my other partners died at the same time. And I think that the sort of the moral obligation, if you found yourself in this fortunate position, is to back, you know, truly revolutionary technologies. And in fact, actually, that's the only way the business model works. So there's like this, there's a moral dimension and there's a very cynical business dimension. Companies that don't sort of radically innovate can be displaced in turn. So if, you know, all you've done is make the widget 10% better, it's not that difficult for someone else to make the widget 11% better by definition. Whereas, you know, if you decide you're going to make a rocket, you know, like one of our companies, SpaceX, does for you, like, you know, a quarter of the cost and hopefully down to an order of magnitude less. Now, that's somewhat more challenging than, you know, another app for the iPhone. Of course, the first three rockets did experience unplanned energetic disassemblies. That was the risk part, but then they worked.
So, Ben, one of the things we've been talking about is disrupting jobs. And in your former life as the CEO of Snapfish, you guys changed the photo industry quite a bit, and some would say not for the better. Can you talk a little bit about that and the moral obligation versus the business obligation?
Sure. Well, so what Snapfish did was a boon for consumers worldwide. So to give you some perspective on Snapfish's scale, my last year at Snapfish, we did approximately 43 million transactions a year, which I think after eBay and Amazon made us the third largest e-commerce network on the planet. A month after iTunes sold its 10 billionth song, we printed our 10 billionth photo. So that was effectively the scale of what we're doing. For consumers, that was fantastic because Snapfish drove prices down for consumers to a great extent. So, you know, I would say for in a non-legalistic way, that if every person on earth was an economist, Snapfish would be a monopoly because you literally would have to get your calculation wrong to use a different service. But the world isn't populated with economists, and there were obviously other companies out there. But in that process, as consumers benefited from price reductions, from more ubiquitous service, from higher quality product, the industry dramatically shrunk. And so, you know, people, you see great successes in the photo business. Instagram, obviously, which was sold for $1 billion. Facebook, which is effectively a photo company that built a bunch of things around it. And things like that. But the photo industry, the industry that actually is working in the photo business and makes its revenue directly from photos, that industry has declined every single year since 2000. And that trend will not reverse. Companies like Kodak have gone bankrupt. Others have been completely shut down. Retailers have exited the business. Manufacturers have exited the business. Producers have exited the business. And thousands upon thousands of people lost their jobs, even though some other jobs were created, but not nearly enough to compensate. So there is a tremendous amount of caution. I think a lot of the implications of this for the workforce is that, you know, in this recession, and now you see corporate profits are up at all-time highs, and jobs don't follow, and everybody is shocked. And I'm shocked that it took so long. I'm absolutely stunned that companies were employing enormous numbers of people that they should never have employed or shouldn't have employed for many, many years, and didn't do something about that before a gun was put to their head in their financial crisis. And today, they're extremely shy about hiring because when you add cost to your business, you're actually not allowing yourself to succeed. You're not allowing yourself to thrive. And so the implications are, unless you are the disruptor, unless you are the creator, right, there is no security. And there's certainly no security in trying to create. But if you get an ability to be around an organization that creates as opposed to defend, that's a good place to be.
Okay, Ryan, since you were the guy who was very much the health expert here on the panel today, so we've got Practice Fusion with health records and changing the way people can manage their own health. You're also an investor in a startup called 100 Plus that's about gamification and DIY health. Can you talk about what the role of health and people staying healthy is going to play in jobs? Say people who used to get a corporate job for the health insurance or the benefits, that's now changed. What do you see the future of everything being and how that's going to impact jobs?
Yeah, I don't know if I see the entire future, Kevin, but I think that some of the things that we see, we actually do them at Practice Fusion, is we give every employee a Fitbit. And so we've gamified this process. We track their steps. We don't weigh them, obviously inappropriate. But what we've seen is as they've gotten healthier, our insurance premiums have actually dropped. So we see that the upfront investment in the technology, in the tracking, which is obviously in an ancillary way creating different jobs in the marketplace, has allowed us to save costs. And those costs are significant on the insurance side, and that candidly allows us to hire more people overall. So our largest macro cost is headcount. If I can lower that, I can hire more people and produce more value into the ecosystem. So we do see a lot of that happening, and that's one of the things we're really excited about.
That's great. Okay, Bruce, so now you are not responsible, but you were part of the team with Peter Thiel that funded Facebook in the very beginning. How do you see Facebook as something to do for the future and the jobs of the future, and what kind of role is Facebook having in our lives today, and how do you see your role in that unfolding? Is there an answer to that question? Maybe not, but something around that question.
It's positive, but for regulatory reasons, since my partner's on the board, I can't answer it. So. Maybe I'll just answer the question more generally about the way in which new companies and new technologies are going to affect the workforce.
Sure, that's fine.
And that was actually my very first deal, so it was a good way to start. I'm actually very optimistic in the near term, after being pessimistic for a very long time about the future of work. In the medium term, I'm extremely bearish, and I think it's going to be near apocalyptic. And in the end, I'm very, very bullish. So I'll go into the reasons why. Never end on a downer, right? So the reason why I'm optimistic in the near term, and this is somewhat self-serving, since I just led around a task rabbit, is that I think labor market intermediation is going to get a lot better. So right now, there's a lot of friction in the labor market. If you want to change jobs, changing jobs is very difficult. Even if you're sort of, you know, highly desirable, you know, aside from maybe the top 1,000 sort of coders in the Valley who, you know, there's no friction in changing jobs. The only friction is like where you send the wire from Google for $100 million. It's just very difficult to change jobs, much less to do casual labor. If you believe in the Ricardian theory of comparative advantage, people should be swapping labor all the time, not just sort of in monolithic, you know, 10-hour-a-day chunks, 12-hour-a-day chunks. But much more frequently. So I think the internet makes exchange of labor much easier. Over the medium term, one of the things that we've been seeing, and obviously you know you participated in this to some extent, is that technology and especially automation and computers are slowly eating away at the lower skilled labor force. And there, you know, if you look at where you know technology really landed first, sort of in industrial manufacturing, those are the jobs that have been gutted the most rapidly. Computers are going to move further and further up the value chain as artificial intelligence in various domains gets better and better. And I think at some point, something like the bottom sort of 80% of the workforce is going to find itself without a great means of sustaining itself economically. How society deals with that is a question for November, but you know, I'll defer to the two self-proclaimed experts on it. In the long haul, and I'll leave it to you to figure out what the long haul is, I think in the end, no one will actually have to do any job that they don't want to do. I think all work will be voluntary and all work will be fulfilling for the simple reason that you only do it because you want to. And this is the positive version of Skynet and when robots take over the world.
And WALL-E as well.
Yeah.
The thinner version of WALL-E, because we'll have 100+ practice fusion. But in the end, we won't be doing very much work at all. I don't know when this is going to come or if it will come within our lifetimes. But I would suggest, as a general heuristic for people, you know, and this is again sort of like radically self-serving, you know, you should just assume that the future is going to be here within your lifetime and plan and do what you want to do. You know, it's much easier. And like the very cynical explanation for this is that it's very hard for people to do what they don't want to do. Something I tried to explain to my mother, who's a tiger mom from China, many times when I was a younger person. But the truth is the world is ruthlessly competitive. And the only way that you're going to be able to work 12 to 14 hours a day, and by the way, that's probably actually what most people in developed economies should be working, is if you love what you do. I don't think that anyone at this table could possibly work the hours required to succeed in their businesses unless they really loved it.
Okay, so I'm going to ask the entire panel now. We're going to turn it over in just a minute for audience questions. But would any of you like to comment on what the other one has said at this point? Ryan, what's it like? What's it like to work with a VC firm? No, Ryan, I'm saying to you, what's your experience as someone who's looking in both directions of taking care of your employees, looking at jobs, also looking at wealth creation and the process? How do you work as a man yourself? How does it work out for you to to balance those out?
I think like when you go my computer. So when I started Practice Fusion, I worked on it like 2 years at my house. Sold my house, sold my car. By the time we got funded, I was 4 years behind on my back taxes. I needed 2 root canals. So it's really interesting. Bruce's quote really resonates with me. The background on my computer for my last 5 computers and for the last 7 years says, "Do what you love." And one of the reasons we had a number of investors in the company before the Founders Fund, and I candidly didn't know who Peter was 2 years ago, and I had a challenging environment I worked in, and someone had introduced me to him, and I tend to consume a lot of content, so I started watching this guy and learning about the Founders Fund philosophy, and really it was very much aligned with if you build something you're passionate about, if you build something that's heavily mission-driven, 3 years from now when it's going really bad, you'll still know why you're doing what you're doing. Your compass will be aligned. That end, mm-hmm. It's going to create a lot more value long-term. And so those are some of the macros I've learned. And then I've also learned if you plant that in your environment, the ultimate incentive for my team and myself is not money, it's not economics, it's not stock, it's happiness, as cheesy as that sounds. So we've created an environment where I feel people are incredibly happy. Like, I can take a person who's just not the happiest person in the world, you know, you meet them and you put them in Practice Fusion, they blossom. And once you have that, it's really hard to leave it, once you kind of go back to kind of cube hell. So we realize that, and that's a big strength we have. And that's kind of some of the things that I've had epiphanies around in the recent months or years.
That's great. Well, Tamara, you've been... Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to comment on, you know, one thing that you talked about is we can't really expect people to sit around and expect the traditional job force to remain the same. I mean, I think something I appreciate being in the design community is, you know, we really look at designing our own environments, our own happiness, our own jobs, and are right on kind of the leading edge of seeing what's going on in technology. And I think there's like a level of obligation to get our economy and our community to think that way, right, and to start moving forward. So I like the way you stated that. I know where I'm cheering you on, even though it's not what I'm here to do.
It's more VC value, I think.
But I'll just chime in a little bit on the VC part. So, you know, I've been in the VC world actually in two separate instances. Snapfish was VC backed for its first 2 years of existence, and now I'm obviously VC-backed, and I kind of skipped the in-between when we were actually a company that was generating our own cash. And there is a remarkable difference from one VC to another. So the philosophy that Founders Fund has, I think, is exceptional. Our backers at Benchmark are... I think unbelievably supportive, have seen everything, have gone through booms, busts, understand the value of the long term. I will tell you that we've had some previous investors in Snapfish that I can talk about because they're not in business anymore, that should not have been in the VC business, did not understand what it meant to be investors, did not understand the concept of long-term value creation. Just to give you a short anecdote, the entire board at Snapfish basically made us sell. Snapfish was sold twice. And so the first time we were sold, it was $43 million put in the company. I was the company CFO at the time. And I was the only one saying, we should not be selling. This was after September 11th. We got $6 million sale price, and I was saying, we don't need to sell. We're going to make it. They didn't believe me, and we sold. The day after we sold, and I kid you not, we became cash flow positive. And we maintained that cash positive throughout our entire history. 3.5 years later, the folks who bought us for $6 million sold us to HP for $300 million. Which would have been a phenomenal return for those investors. And by the way, HP got a bargain because a couple of years after that, Snapfish's value was substantially higher. So the right VC can understand that market cycles don't determine the value of what you're building, but truly building something valuable. The overwhelming majority of VCs who have not been through several of those cycles will not be able to understand it. So beware.
Mm-hmm. Tamara, I wanted to ask you a question. You've been at two different organizations that do a lot of corporate training or executive training. You're at Adaptive Path and you have a number of conferences that they do at Adaptive Path that are training for design professionals. You were at Cooper with Cooper U, which is a very unique kind of educational opportunity for people. How do you see that kind of training as compared to traditional training? And what the importance of it for the future.
Yeah, I think Cooper U has a really great program called UX Bootcamp, and that's a good situation that they'll work with a UX team, and in a 4 or 5 day period, they'll actually develop a product. So I think it's, and we did some pretty rapid prototyping for you guys when it came to your iPad application. So I think those kind of tools and skills are making a really big impact on trying to design immediately and create product that is profitable and keeping the companies going or getting them more innovative and thinking, right, and building their skill set.
So, Ben, are we going to be educating people for skills or for leadership?
It depends who they are. You know, there's the fact of the matter is that if you have, and this is actually one of the things that, you know, Ryan was talking about with regards to people saying, oh, you know, I've never worked a day in my life, but I'd like to run strategy. There are a lot of people, especially now with this explosion of seed funding for startups, that have absolutely no background. They've gone and come up with some inane idea that they somehow got funded for absolutely no reason, pivoted their way to burning all their cash and went out of business, but they were CEO. And so, of course, their next, you know, job should at the very least be, I mean, they'll take a step down to a vice president, but they're completely clueless. They don't know, they have no concept of leadership, they have no concept of skill of any kind. And they actually become a drain. By the way, those people in 2011 wound up being taxi cab drivers in San Francisco. That day will return. These are not permanent boom times. And for people who are leasing 100,000 square feet of office space at $75 a square foot in San Francisco, I know how that story ends. It's not pretty. And so some people, in fact, the overwhelming majority of people do need to learn skills and very specific skills. They need to know how to not just master something, but how to continuously learn how to master more and more things as they progress in their career. And that mastery, as long as you have a thirst for learning and a thirst for flexibility, you'll do fine. There are a very, very small group of people in the world that are destined for leadership, that are destined to organize a group of other people and lead them, tackle the big mountain. And that is a separate form of skill. And there is going to be, we're obviously ones that are focused on that, but there will be a small group of institutions and places that will really teach people how to do that. I mean, one of the most famous leadership institutes in the world was, and for many years, been GE, right, where for many regards, they graduated a number of executives that were then quite successful in other businesses because they were able to take those practices and apply them to other places. So there's no value judgment on vocational training, on skills-based training, on liberal training, on liberal arts training, on leadership training. But the thing that is going to be common to all of them is that people have to have mastery and the thirst for constant reinvention and constant learning more and more things. Without those two areas, it doesn't really matter what you're doing. You're going to do your. I think your future will not be bright if you don't seize both of them.
Thanks, Ben. I'd like to let our audience know that we're going to be turning it over for audience questions in just a moment. We do have two microphones here. I would also like to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. Our program tonight, Startups, VC, Design, and the Jobs of the Future. Our panelists are Ben Nelson, Ryan Howard, Bruce Gibney, and Tamara Wayland. So, Bruce, I wanted to ask you, it's an extension of the question, skills or leadership. But I specifically wanted to ask you about the 20 Under 20 program that you've done through Founders Fund. And I've heard some criticism of it. I've heard some great things about it. What's your take as one of the people behind it?
Well, first of all, for those of people who have an apocalyptic, vision of 20 under 20, it's like if the U.S. is really going to go down because 20 kids dropped out of college, we have other problems. So I'm not, I think that probably disposes of the apocalyptic version. The positive version, which I think is true, is that there are 20. There are more than 20. There are considerably more than 20. Extraordinary individuals who are ready to start companies in our universities or outside of our universities at this time. And again, sort of, if you think that that's not the case, this country has a lot more problems. So the only thing that I'd say is that over time, it would be nice if we could be even more ambitious. It's probably, 2020 or something like that.
How many companies have you actually created or have been created that you guys have followed through with?
Well, about a half dozen companies have been created and have been funded by a variety of sources. The program is just entering its second year, so time will tell.
Okay. All right. Well, at this point, I'm going to turn it over to the audience for some questions, and we'll start over here.
Is it on?
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah. I'm John Wolpert. I'm one of the team members on Upstart Mobile, which we spun out of Best Buy a few years ago and makes Cabulous, which just passed, I think, a million rides, taxi rides. So there are a few taxi drivers that we know. Question is about education and hiring. So one of the youngest members of our team early on was bemoaning his huge school debt. And I think we all probably agree that schools have priced themselves out of the market. They just don't know it yet. And he said, today education is everything, but schools are nothing, which I thought was very interesting. But it also kind of troubled me because I started out in school as a theater major, then an English major, then I started writing code, and I got personal diversity from my school experience. Without that experience, I've hired hundreds of engineers, but I'm always looking for personal diversity. It's harder and harder to find that. I don't think we need STEM. We need STEAM, right? We need science, technology, engineering, arts, et cetera. Where are we going to find that in the future?
Well, I think you're gonna find it in a lot of places. And the reason for that is because the higher education system is a protected industry. And so some people who are crazy like we are going off and creating a brand new university from scratch. So we go and we're getting our accreditation. We're going to democratize effectively the very high end of higher education. We have a different philosophy on admissions than most. But what the system is actually encouraging is not people like me. This is the reason we're the only ones doing what we're doing. What is encouraging is actually folks, institutions like 20 Under 20 and many, many others that are rejecting the system out of hand. And so what they're doing is that because of accreditation, because of the protected nature of the industry, what it's doing is it's forcing innovation outside. And you see very rapid education innovation outside of the formal education industry. Again, much of it, like in most educational environment or most entrepreneurial environments, is terrible. Some of it is going to be really fantastic. And the things that will be very good will catch on and will provide the kinds of training, the kinds of skills that students are going to need in a variety of different areas. So I think you're going to see a lot of interesting answers pop up outside of the industry because the industry is forcing them out.
I think education is quite interesting because it's viewed as this really, really precious commodity. It's incredibly expensive. not everyone can go to school, et cetera, et cetera. And I tend to disagree with that. And I think I was watching Elon Musk at the he was keynoting one of the TechCrunch events last year, and he talked about He was like, at some point in the near future, this will be commoditized in such a way and democratized in such a way where it will be that of a big film budget, the production quality. So we'll take, you know, think about, I'm into, here's my bad example, I love the X-Men and I love comic books, right? So take the new X-Men movie, Hugh Jackman makes a great Wolverine, right? So who's the best star that can be in this? Who's the best teacher to teach economics? And then take production quality. If I had a 10, 20, the Wolverine comic book has an $80 million budget. So imagine if I gave this teacher, you know, a Hollywood set production quality video. And then we already have distribution. I'm not going to point out the obvious with the internet. But what that is happening now, and it's becoming commoditized by people that on the lower end, but I think it will go upstream at some point soon. And I personally look really forward to that because a lot of my education was more or less self-taught, and I think the emergence of online video was Howard Schultz is one of my mentors, and that's great in Fine and Dandy that I can read his book, but I've watched hundreds of hours of content on him. I've watched dozens of hours of content on Peter, not as much as you, Bruce, but enough on you.
we see each other now.
We see each other a lot. That's where, you know, it was interesting when Elon pointed this out. It really shifted my paradigm, and I look forward to that happening, and I think it will very soon.
Bruce, what do you think about that?
I think the most important thing in education right now is probably to increase or decrease the feedback cycle, the latency period between of the things that Ben is not already addressing directly and perfectly. I would try to increase the response time because that's the only way to obtain mastery, especially in technical subjects. You know, it used to be the case that I'd hand in my problem sets in math and I'd get them returned a week later, maybe. And I had totally forgotten that I'd done the problem set, and so it wasn't a useful pedagogical experience. And actually, one of the reasons why I think we do very, very well in CS is because you get feedback right away, whereas in almost every other discipline, you know, it takes your TA like 10 days to get it back. And having been a TA myself, I can tell you, you get a B plus no matter what. No, seriously, you have to optimize, you know, because if they deserve a B plus, then they're very, you know, they got what they deserved. If they should have gotten an A minus, they don't really know. Anything less, they're happy. And if they really deserved an A, they'll complain. And actually, I'm what's wrong with the educational system because that shouldn't be the feedback mechanism. And I turn things in late. So that's my view on education as someone who has corrupted it from within.
We won't offer you a job as a professor.
Yeah. I'm going to go to you were second, and then we'll go over to you.
There was a question at the beginning from the moderator, and it pertained to the mobile interface and changing the face of employment. There was a response from Acer that Microsoft going into tablets, they're not good at, Microsoft is not good at it, and I guess Acer doesn't want to become, is that adaptive? No, I'm misusing adaptive path. Could you comment on this recent development?
I'm not sure that was what we were talking about.
To Microsoft going into tablets, manufacturing that hardware?
I think that you might have confused Adaptive Path, which is an innovation and design company, with a different tablet. And do you guys have any answer to that one? I think let's talk after the program. I think that might be a different question than what we were talking about.
Yes, my name is Aaron Donsky. I university professor spent most of my life in higher education and sort of feel like a staff member in a Titanic. I teach in MBA programs in the U.S. and in China, and the problems are the same, actually, in some ways. But I wanted to get your comment. Clayton Christensen, who many of you have read, I'm sure the father of disruptive innovation theories, recently wrote in Harvard Magazine about higher ed, saying that he thought that the growth of the for-profit sector, which is enormous, as you know, here in the United States, is on its way to disrupting all of higher education. Even indicated he thought that maybe he questioned the viability of Harvard itself. And, of course, he's a Harvard professor. And so I want to get your comments, some of you, on this growth of the for-profit sector in higher education.
That question was for you, Bruce.
I think there's someone actually who's in a better position to answer, but I'll lead off and then they can rescue me. I think the analogy of the Titanic is apt because Ivy League institutions are large, theoretically over-engineered, luxurious things that haven't adapted to the age that they're in. I mean, I went to a school that had a golf course, for Pete's sake. What the devil does that have to do with coding? Yeah, so it was a very nice golf course. Stanford is a very nice golf course. But yes, I think that in the end, the enormous endowments, the social prestige, the entrenchment with the political elite has insulated and to a very dangerous degree these institutions from market pressures. And the fact that it's also almost impossible for students to affect reform from within, with the possible exception of whatever the political moment du jour is, actually changing the course of the system itself will be subject to the most reactionary politics you could possibly expect from left-leaning institutions. So I guess I do agree with your emotive content in this, but perhaps you have a different.
So I'll talk a little bit about the concept of less about nonprofit for-profit, which I actually believe the tax status of an organization is completely irrelevant, and I think you can see that in a case in point on the quote unquote low end by looking at what I believe are the two most disruptive universities out there on the low end today, and that is Western Governors, a nonprofit university that is offering degrees at about $5,000 a year tuition, and University Now, which is undercutting them by half, also offering an accredited degree, all competency-based, what Western Governors was supposed to be doing, but actually University Now is doing. And I think that Clay's perspective is exactly right in the sense that these types of organizations are going to come to market, and both, and especially University Now, because they have rejected Title IV. And so even though they're an accredited university, they're creating a market-driven product, a product where you actually pay out of pocket, and therefore if you don't actually get value, they're not going to be in business. And so it holds them to a higher level than anybody else. I think they're going to be incredibly successful, incredibly disruptive because of that. We are obviously looking at the exact opposite end of the spectrum, and we're trying to redefine what it is that elite education is. I'm not sure if Clay really thinks that we're going to be putting Harvard out of business. That's certainly not our intention. But we certainly want to dramatically expand and redefine that category. I do think that in higher education, what lies in between is going to have a pretty hard time in the coming 5, 15, 25 years. And I think there's going to be a lot of difference in the landscape because of for-profits and just new entrants in general.
Like the analogy of the 80% of jobs being restructured.
I would like to add one thing. I actually do think that some of our institutions of higher education are some of the noblest things that we've ever done. But they are luxury products in many respects. And in fact, actually, education started as a luxury product. There are some aspects of education that will always remain a luxury product. We have revolutionized education before, 150 years ago, with the land-grant colleges, which had a mission to promote social utility. You know, no matter what I say about Stanford, the truth is I'm very proud to have gone there, and I love it. Unfortunately, it's not it can't be everything to everyone.
Okay, we have time for about two more questions, but let's see what we can get out of.
I'll be brief. I'm Tony. Hello. My question is, you talk about the 80% jobs being basically built up and commoditized, and in the flat world and so forth. I'm interested in any observations you might have, though, about the so-called intermediary professions like sales, certain kinds of executive recruiting, which require negotiations and personal skills. I've seen a transformation, but I see some areas where it's, I think, destined to remain. I'm very interested in your observations on this.
Well, Tamara, that's obviously going to come to you. How do you see this all changing now?
I think there's, it's really amazing how much business I've done without ever meeting anyone, right? And that's encouraging and discouraging at the same time. Technology really allows us to do a lot. But there's, I think the human connection is still very powerful. I mean, I can tell you when I fly across the country or to another part of the world to meet with someone, the value that you have, and I think building relationships is still really important, and that we're going to need that just from a pure humanity level. We need that, right? So, I mean, my goal obviously is to keep that very much alive.
Ryan, what's your take on that one?
I think we when you deconstruct our company, about a quarter of it is excuse me, customer service and account management, and I think the human condition requires that that interaction's there. And I think I'm wrong on his last name, but I think his name is Daniel Goldman, Harvard professor, actually wrote a book called Stumbling on Happiness, and he went through all these different case studies of what makes people happy. But at the end of the day, it's just interaction, and that's really critical. I think the ability to build rapport, trust in a relationship, and sell any product or distribute anything of real meaning is critical on an individual and the critical thinking. And I think we're many lifetimes away from having that commoditized. So otherwise, I mean, why would I want to be alive anymore, right, if everything was commoditized? So I do think Tamar made a really interesting comment. I've raised millions of dollars on the phone without ever meeting someone. So I think, you know, technology eliminates friction,
yeah,
definitely. But there's no replacement for the necessity and the required consumption of the human condition. So I think it's still a huge part of our business. When we call a doctor up, we're like, I want you to give me all the data on your practice, give me all the data about all your doctors, take this piece of technology you've never seen before, you have no mental model for, you've never used before, and just start using it tomorrow. And like, my guys are really, really persuasive, and there's no other way of building that trust and rapport. So it's definitely a necessity in our business. It's not going anywhere anytime soon.
And how? So I was lucky enough to go to the Practice Fusion big event you had for all your doctors and users who are doctors and their staff last fall. I was amazed. I mean, it was like 1,200 people there, and you exposed a new product that Tamara had helped to create, and it was just amazing to see So my question here is, I was just amazed at everyone you guys from Practice Fusion brought together in one place, and the power of the face to face. How does that relate to both work environments and to education in general? And after that, we're going to have time for one more question. But let's maybe you start.
One of my simple philosophies is whether it's within the office and people I work with, or working with Tamara or Bruce, for that matter, and you guys as well, and we don't work together.
But, no,
people.
Not yet.
And the quote I'm about to say has nothing to do with you, but people do business with people they like, period. And I think, you know, that's really, really critical in everything that we do. And I don't know if that answers your question, but I mean, I think you're willing to compromise on other values, the school you went to, if we have a common vision, we communicate well. That's one of the reasons we like each other, and we're able to drive towards a common mission. And that's one thing that I've seen that, again and again, makes any relationship sustainable long-term, and then allows us to get to a longer-term goal of producing something of value.
Bruce, do you have any?
Yeah, in speculative businesses, there's really no substitute for, I guess, human interaction, because the truth is that, you know, young businesses, it's not sort of, you know, like people are like, oh, it's like a hockey stick. Yeah, it's like several hockey sticks stuck together, and then there's like an upside down hockey stick, then there's like a flat line, and then there's like an exponential, because like it goes all over the map. And the thing that allows you to, you know, sort of continue on in this otherwise sort of stressful set of conditions is your faith in the team. And you will have no faith in the team if you haven't met them and spent time with them.
So, Ben, you are going to have physical gatherings for your students. They're going to live together in a number of countries over their time. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're obviously huge believers in what you learn in the real world. We believe that formal education can be substantially improved by actually making it virtual, so maintaining the concept of a classroom, but for the first time since Socrates, effectively reinventing what that means, but maintaining live interactive, highly curated experiences. But offline, we really think that the world is becoming much smaller and much more urban, and we want to have our students experience that. So our goal is, by the time a Minerva graduate is done with their education, that they would have lived in 7 different countries and experienced that with fellow students all over the world. And we think that that is by far the best offline experience, rather than sequestering them in a walled castle somewhere in the wilderness for 4 years. We really think we want them out there living and experiencing the world together.
You mean like the...
I
want to
go.
MinervaProject.com. Keep a close look.
Okay, well, unfortunately, we've reached a time in our program where we only have time for one more question. I would like to let our audience listening at home know this is the Commonwealth Club of California, our program tonight, Startups, VCs, Design, and the Jobs of the Future. Our panelists are Ben Nelson, Ryan Howard, Bruce Gibney, and Tamara Wayland. I'm Kevin O'Malley, Chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum. And thank you all for being here tonight. We're going to turn it over for our last question, and then we're going to wrap up.
Great, thank you. I've run a small tech company for quite a while, sort of perpetual startup mode. But one of the problems I've always had is sort of maintaining sort of work-life balance. And, you know, it's very easy to be passionate about something and but still work 14, 16-hour days and, you know, completely burn out on it. And so I guess my question is, you know, what, you know, for the panelists, what kind of... you know, strategies do you guys have for, you know, maintaining that, you know, that balance? And also that includes, you know, continuing education. That's one of the things I find I don't have a lot of time for. And so how do you guys manage that, and how do you encourage your employees to manage that?
One of my mentors always used to tell me that life is a balance of health, wealth, and love. And so basically imagine a pie chart and imagine, you know, equilibrium in that. And whenever you focus on, so health is eating healthy and taking care of yourself. Wealth is not just money, it's your job, your passion. Love is deep intimate relationships as well as friendships as well. And whenever you focus any time too much on one of those things, one or the other two will get dysfunctional. And I saw that to the extreme when I started Practice Fusions. I can definitely relate to you. And it got to a point where I actually got like really deep social anxiety, so I didn't even like going out. And so we have a lot of our company's history is talks about how like I started the company at Starbucks, and that isn't really quite true. It was that I was just so socially debilitated that I had to get out of the house every day and start being social again. But I noticed that I think ultimately for me the pulse is on myself. Like I need to keep myself accountable, and when I do it, I become a much more narrow person. I become, you know, I'm super fun generally, but I'm not less fun, less well-rounded, can't talk about a diversity of subjects. And you know, so for myself, it's really critical. I think, are you the founder of the company? So I think you always have a different burden that you're bearing, you know, whether it's payroll or making sure everyone's happy. And you might take a couple extra bullets, but making sure your team has that as well. The reality is they're spending the vast majority of their time there. And so, you know, when you walk into our space, it is culture. It's really, really deep and ingrained. And we invest a tremendous amount, whether it's space or the people or training or the experience or food. You know, there's all these things where we serve dinner every night. And Peter and I actually had deep dialogues around, is that more or less productive? And one day he told me, he's like, the net is, Ryan, is that if you're keeping the people social and happy and decompressing them at the end of the day, then the cost for all the food was actually worth it, not in productivity, but in morale. And so these are some of the things I think a lot about, but it's definitely critical. You know, no one's going to want to work with you after a while if you're a total asshole, you know. I know from experience.
I mean, I think myself personally, I have the great fortune of working with guys like this and working with highly creative people in design firms. I'm also a mom, right? So that balance is critical to me. And kind of around education and delivering inspiration to my kids. For me, they really keep me grounded. And I think, you know, Ryan referenced the things that he knows he needs to do in his personal life. And if you just find that focus, what you know you need to sustain, and if you don't have that, none of it's really worth it. You're fine.
Ben, what's your take on all that?
Well, you know, it really depends on your situation. We had a period where, you know, at Snapfish, where people were just working unsustainably long hours, but they weren't creating the kind of value that they needed to. Mm-hmm. So I banned meetings 4 days a week, mm-hmm. banned them, and hours went down, productivity shot through the roof. So that was one of our malaises, and it was an easy fix, though controversial. But if you really find yourself in a situation where you really are out of balance and your team's out of balance, rethink the way you do things. Shake it up a little bit. Even if it seems counterintuitive, even if you think it'll be highly destructive, a week of experimentation can do a tremendous amount of good and may teach you something.
Yeah. Bruce, the voice of optimism.
Yeah.
You're all going to get ready for the apocalypse now. Yeah. Because after this program, it's all over.
I would outsource as much as you possibly can that's not core to your mission. The second thing I would do is, if you have a larger company, you already know that people need to fire them right away. They're taking up too much of your time. And the third is, and relatedly, anything that you have like a nagging doubt about, where you just think to yourself, oh God, do I have to do this? Do I have to do that? And it's not in your heart of hearts, you know it's not core to your mission, get rid of it or push it off on somebody else. Because the amount of time human beings waste in the day doing things that, you know, aren't real work, or that they do out of guilt, or because it provides a small gamification reward, I filled in my expense report. Who cares? You can find other things to do with your time. So move up the value chain.
Okay, good. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time right now. So our panelists will be around. You can ask them questions directly. I would like to thank you all for being here tonight. I'd like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club. And I would like to thank our audience listening at home. Our program tonight has been Startups, VCs, Designs, and the Job of the Future. Our panelists, Ben Nelson, Ryan Howard, Bruce Gibney, and Tamara Wayland. And with this, our program is adjourned. Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you so much.